Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program very remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Thursday, March 31st, 2022. Some South Sudanese leaders are adding their voices to the call for President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar to sit down and talk.
There is an agreement in place now, and that is our hope, the hope of everyone. And we are also happy with the statement of the President that he will never take the country back to the war, and we amen that.
And some residents of the South Sudan's capital, Juba, are praising President Salva Kiir for reaching out to Riek Machar for a resolution of the political standoff in the country.
The fact that the first vice president responded positively, saying that he does not plan to bring the country back into war, means that he is also willing to implement the agreement that they both signed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, is appealing for $1.7 billion to assist 6.8 million people in need of humanitarian aid this year in South Sudan. OCHA's deputy head of office in South Sudan says the funds will be used to assist people affected by hunger, flooding, insecurity, and displacement, as well as 2 million internally displaced persons in South Sudan.
Today in South Sudan, we estimate that there's about 8.9 million people who have needs that are assessed against what we would see as a humanitarian requirement. Now, that could be that someone is ill and they need healthcare. They're in a situation where they have not enough access to safe drinking water. It could be a child who's been separated and we need them to come and find their family. However, of course, there is no way, as just the humanitarians, that we can provide all the support that's needed for everyone everywhere. It's within the limited resources we would be able to raise. So as the humanitarians, what we have defined is that of that 8.9 million, we are going to do our best to target 6.8 million people. And that's a huge number, but that is what we're going to try to do. And to enable that action, there will always be a cost. So the estimate is $1.7 billion. And we know that's a lot. But let me just give you some of the breakdown as to what that would mean. So for children who are malnourished across the country, for women who are pregnant or lactating, the support that they would require, we estimate that that would need $230 million to provide basic food assistance, livelihood support, food security elements. That is always going to be the biggest one. And the estimated cost for food security and livelihood is $650 million. Education, ensuring that the children have access to education for the future, that will cost $54 million. Now, let me just talk about the people themselves for a moment. The estimates right now is that there are over 2 million people who've been forced to displace from their homes in South Sudan. And some of these are people who were displaced in the years past, including from flooding in 2020 and in 2021. And their areas of origin are still not accessible for them to go home.
You've already mentioned food security, displacement because of insecurity and flooding. So what would you say are the major factors driving humanitarian needs in South Sudan today?
I think you've captured them there just even in how you summarized. So with people who are fleeing right now because of the violence that they experienced in the Ugok and Annette area, some of them have gone further north, others have come down south into Warap, across and even into Bahar al-Ghazal. I was there myself about a week ago, and some of the people told us they fled with the clothes they're wearing. When the flooding happens, it's the same. Sometimes the families are able to grab a blanket or a saucepan, a knife, so that they can move and go elsewhere, but not always. So it's a combination. It's people who feel unsafe, people impacted by flooding, in terms of the impact of some of the violence. And for some of these people who flee, they've actually experienced a multitude of these different things that force them to leave their home.
And in terms of geographic areas, as we know, different areas in South Sudan have different humanitarian needs. We have arable and fertile lands around the equatorial region, for example, where food should be plenty, but issues of insecurity might affect cultivation of food. Whereas up in the north, around Unity, Upper Nile, even Warab, flooding is the major factor driving humanitarian needs. How do you break it down generally, geographically speaking?
So across the country, we have different pockets of area, exactly as you said, where there's the different needs. Some of the areas that are of absolute focus are, for example, in Bentu, where you have people who were affected consecutive years with the flooding, but also had displaced because of violence. And now the standing water from 2021 did not go away. So as soon as it rains, we're worried that that will increase. But these are also a population who've been exposed to disease outbreaks, malaria, diarrhea among the children. This is the reality. If you go further north, up around to the northern Warab, as I say, we now have people who have had to flee because of violence, and they have really complex and absolute humanitarian needs. But across all, they need emergency shelters, they need soap, they need mental health and psychosocial support. It is that whole spectrum. Then down south, in Western Equatoria, the violence of last year resulted in over 80,000 people who were impacted. Some of them, exactly as you say, from the breadbasket. This is the area that produced, and now they're displaced. They can't even cultivate as they would normally do. Just south of where we are right now in Juba, the violence in Magui has forced people to flee.
Let's talk about funding. You're appealing for $1.7 billion this year. How much funding do you have at your disposal, and what services will you direct the funds towards?
Very honestly, I cannot tell you how much funding has currently been made available. How it works is that the donors provide, often bilaterally, to a partner, and that's their contractual arrangement. And it's then reported usually at the end of every quarter. So here we are on the last day of March. So in April, that information would be more available. The 1.7 billion is a huge amount, and we're very aware of that. And of course, it is a request.
Yes.
Will it definitely all be provided? We would hope so, but we also have to be realistic.
That was Annette Hans, OCHA's Deputy Head of Office in South Sudan. She was speaking to Nabil Biagio from Juba earlier today. Some church leaders in South Sudan are urging the parties to the revitalized peace agreement to resolve their differences through dialogue to prevent the country from returning to war. The Archbishop of the Central Equatoria Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says the people of South Sudan are looking to the parties for leadership to resolve outstanding issues in the 2018 peace agreement. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Paul Yugusuk, Archbishop of the Central Equatoria Internal Province of the Episcopal Church, says the parties should stop accusing each other of wrongdoing and focus on dialogue to resolve their differences. Archbishop Yugusuk says Citizen One, the main signatories to the peace agreement, the SPLM in government and SPLM in opposition, to show leadership and prevent the country from moving backwards. He says President Salva Kiir should remain true to his words that he will never return the country to war. He says the parties should expedite the implementation of the key provisions of the agreement, such as security arrangements, before the transitional period expires.
There is an agreement in place now, and that is our hope, the hope of everyone. And we are also happy with the statement of the president that he will never take the country back to the war. And he meant that, and I know he will never do that. And we are happy with this statement, and we believe that he will take us forward. So this confrontation should not be welcome among us at this time. We know things are very sensitive, but we are arguing our leaders is the implementation. Any argument, any work, anything is the implementation. So we should put all our efforts towards the implementation of the River Talang peace agreement so that we have election on time.
Elections are scheduled to take place in February 2023. The SPLM-IO announced a few weeks ago they will no longer participate in the Peace Monitoring Body, RJMEC, and Security Mechanism meetings. The group accused SSPDF of carrying out what it called unprovoked attacks on its military bases. The SSPDF denied the charges. Yugusuk says now is the time for all parties to come together and move on. David Leung, the Bishop of Jonglei Diocese of the Sudan Pentecostal Church, says the latest security development in the country is unfortunate because South Sudanese do not want to see a repeat of the 2013 and 2016 conflicts.
We are appealing to the leaders of this country, let them not take the country back to the war. Without peace, there is no development. Without peace, there is no any change that can happen. All citizens in South Sudan are working hard to get to change their life from this miserable life to a good life. So without peace, nobody can go a step ahead. And the war, we know that war always a destructive agent against development. Where there is war, nothing can change in South Sudan.
Bishop Leung urged the parties to stop bickering and initiate dialogue so that South Sudanese can believe in the future of their country. The U.S. government has called on President Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar to de-escalate tensions and uphold their respective obligations under the 2018 agreement, including its ceasefire provision. In a statement released on Tuesday, the U.S. State Department expressed concern over what it called deteriorating situation in South Sudan. It cited recent clashes between the SSPDF and the SPLM-AIO in Upper Nile and Unity States, saying neither Kiir nor Machar have made good faith efforts to implement key provisions in the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
Some residents of the South Sudan's capital, Juba, are welcoming President Salva Kiir's initiative to reach out to First Vice President Riek Machar to end the recent standoff over unresolved issues in the 2018 peace agreement. David Monodanga has more for VOA from Juba.
On Tuesday, President Kiir sent the SPLM Interim Secretary General, Peter Lamboth, to meet Machar to reassure him that the president is committed to implementing all provisions of the peace deal, especially unifying the forces and their command structure.
The two have committed themselves to harmonize the provisions on the issue of the command structure for the organized forces. Once the team from Khartoum comes back, those discussions will continue. He is also working on how the mechanisms, the especially members of IO, the mechanisms can return, so that peace can continue to be implemented. So there is no reason for alarm in our country. Our leaders are working together.
Pauk Both Balwang, spokesperson in the office of the first vice president, confirmed to South Sudan in Focus today that President Kiir said he is committed to addressing all the issues the SPLM-IO raised on security arrangements.
And also the president's willingness to have a direct engagement with the first vice president regarding the implementation of the peace agreement and all issues pertaining to its implementation. The second one was the readiness of the president to address all the issues raised by the SPLM-IO components in the security mechanisms and in CBTAM and RJMA to be resolved and addressed so that they can return back to attend the meetings of this mechanisms.
Citizens have welcomed President Kiir's assurance to the SPLM-IO of his pledge to address continuous issues that led to the withdrawal of SPLM-IO from security mechanism meetings. Juba resident Moni Tabita says sending Peter Lamboth to meet with Riek Machar shows Kiir's genuine willingness to implement the peace agreement.
Also, the fact that the first vice president responded positively, saying that he does not plan to bring the country back into war, means that he is also willing to implement the agreement that they both signed. And as a citizen of South Sudan, we really want both parties to keep their promise of not sending this country into war, because we have really fought enough and we need to develop this country. We need to see new things happening in this country. So, in short, we want peace as South Sudanese.
Patrick Godi, another resident of Juba, says it is important that Kiir and Machar engage in dialogue consistently and stick to their promises to keep South Sudan peaceful.
We want to see these not as mere words, but as actions. And what are the kind of actions we want to see? We want to see progress in the implementation of the security arrangement, so that these violations of the cessation of hostilities and the ceasefire will stop, and we'll have unified army that will take security of the whole country.
Godi says whenever unilateral decisions are made, it backfires and it returns the country to an atmosphere of war, something he says South Sudanese citizens least expect at a time when efforts should be made to fully implement the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. How is Russia's invasion of Ukraine affecting arms sales to Africa? Find out more after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Following its invasion of Ukraine, countries of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, or NATO, imposed comprehensive sanctions on Russia in a bid to cripple its ability to participate meaningfully in the global economy. The wide-ranging sanctions could affect Africa's ability to produce and maintain military hardware from Russia. Reporter Angie Omar discussed the risks and opportunities of this analysis with Cameron Hudson, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former chief of staff at the office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan.
I think that the world is trying to isolate the Russian economy. One of the aspects of Russia, their trading relationship with the continent is arms sales figure very prominently and heavily. But I would also suggest that it has not been beneficial to the continent to have those arms sales, especially when you look at the principal purchasers of those, namely Sudan. So the fact that Russian arms may be less available on the African continent, I think, not necessarily a bad thing.
Almost half of Africa's imports of military equipment, 49%, come from Russia. By comparison, China accounts for 13% of the continent's arms imports. Do you think Africa might shift to China for its military exports instead of Russia?
Well, I think that Africa is going to seek military hardware and assistance from whoever is offering the most attractive terms and offering the most attractive hardware for the needs. I mean, obviously, you have to look at some of the conflicts that are playing out in Africa right now, and you're seeing that it isn't just a question of Russia or China. The United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Kuwait have become significant players. Egypt, a significant player in arms sales across the continent. And so I think you're going to see a diversity of actors that are engaging in arms sales taking over, filling the vacuum and void left over by the Russian involvement.
The biggest buyers of armaments from Russia and most longstanding importers are Algeria, Angola, Burkina Faso, Egypt, Ethiopia, Morocco, and Uganda. Egypt and Algeria are in the top 10 list of major importers in the world. Could the U.S. and Western countries replace Russia in arms sales to Africa?
I think that that's not something that the United States would be particularly well placed to do, given, I think, the agenda that Washington has in trying to limit conflict on the continent. I think you're seeing right now a lot of effort to try to move away from a purely securitized approach to dealing with African countries and engaging African countries. You know, you've seen the number of coup d'etats in Africa sharply rise in the last 6 months. And I think there's some questioning here in Washington about whether or not, you know, a military first approach to engaging African governments is in fact the right approach, especially with the Biden administration trying to say that it is placing a new emphasis on democracy and governance issues on the continent.
That was Cameron Hudson of the Atlantic Council speaking to reporter Angie Omar. Rights group Amnesty International has issued a scathing report on the failure of global drug companies and Western governments to quickly provide COVID vaccines to millions of people in Africa. In its annual report, Amnesty says tens of thousands of deaths could have been prevented if companies put people before profits and if governments were less nationalistic. Mohammed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
In its report for 2021, Amnesty International says Africa was discriminated against by wealthy nations and international corporations who failed to quickly distribute COVID-19 vaccines. Speaking in Nairobi, Deputy Regional Director of Amnesty International East Africa, Sarah Jackson, said African countries were among the last to get the vaccines.
We see a global system that has prioritized vaccines for the few, that has prioritized vaccines for wealthy countries, and there's been very limited vaccine rollout in this region. And yet at the same time, there are a whole host of problems that have arisen in the way in which vaccines have been distributed. They're often coming in at short notice with very limited expiry dates. And this makes it very difficult for governments to build effective information campaigns to overcome distrust and misinformation that is prevalent among some segments of the population.
African governments have struggled to purchase vaccines in the global market due to high demand and scarcity. Some African countries accuse wealthy nations of hoarding vaccines. Erastus Mwencha, a former deputy chairperson of the Africa Union Commission, echoes that view.
Apathism of vaccine, I mean, you saw in the global north, vaccines that were expiring when actually global south. In other words, Africa is seen as a nuisance value, but yet if you think of even the pandemic, there's no way the rest of the world can be happy if Africa is sick.
In its effort to make vaccines more available on the continent, the Africa Centers for Disease Control has pushed for greater production of vaccines on the continent. The push has paid off as American pharmaceutical giant Moderna is expected to set up vaccine production plants in 5 African countries. The Amnesty report praised Rwanda for vaccinating 40% of its population. Researchers were also encouraged by the effort of Burundian and Tanzanian authorities to focus more on the pandemic after they initially rejected health measures to contain the virus. Still, only 10% of Africans are vaccinated, the lowest rate among all the world's continents. Amnesty International also accused some African governments of using COVID health protocols to control or to punish their citizens. Jackson says the government used lockdowns and restrictions of movement to abuse people.
We've seen that a number of governments in the region, particularly actually the year before in 2020, but also sometimes in 2021 have limited the right to freedom of assembly. I'm thinking particularly of the Ugandan context around the Ugandan elections in the name of COVID-19. And this has impacted the rights of citizens to organize, to assemble.
Amnesty International is calling on African citizens to stand up for their rights and resist any attempt to muzzle their voices. The rights groups will be launching a global campaign demanding respect for the right to protest. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report on the human rights situation in Central African Republic says combating impunity is key to achieving national reconciliation and a durable peace in the war-torn country. The report from a UN investigator was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council on Monday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report says atrocities and human rights violations continue to be committed by various armed groups in the Central African Republic, including by the mainly Muslim ex-Seleka, the largely Christian anti-Balaka and Faka, the armed forces of the CAR. UN investigator Yawa Betse accuses them of pillaging and looting villages and of threatening the civilian population with violence to exact illegal taxes. He expresses particular concern about reports of ongoing human rights abuse by Russian mercenaries employed by the Wagner Group, a private security company which reportedly has close ties with Faka. He says witnesses have reported many crimes perpetrated by the mercenaries. Agbetse told the council they include sexual violence, intimidation, destruction of homes, racketeering, and torture. He speaks through an interpreter.
The Russian bilateral forces have also hindered investigations where violations of human rights were committed. As regards contractual relations with the CAR, under international law, the Russian bilateral forces are not a recognized international body.
Therefore, said Agbetse, the responsibility for violations falls on the Central African Republic government, which must take all measures to achieve justice for the victims. In response, CAR Minister of Justice Jubai Abazene told the UN Council that his government is making major reforms. He says that it is improving the security sector and has a new judicial and court system which is working to shed light on allegations of human rights abuse. He speaks through an interpreter.
Investigations are now open for all presumed allegations in cases of human rights violations, whoever the perpetrators may be and whatever their positions may be. They will be brought to justice and punished. You can be reassured of that.
The president of the CAR Truth, Justice and Reparations Committee, Marie-Edith Duzima, said 87% of the population thinks it is possible to have lasting peace in the CAR, providing those responsible for violence are punished. She said it is vital to combat impunity for the CAR to find a way out of the repeated crises afflicting the country. She noted that to date, no victims of sexual or other crimes have received compensation and reparations. That wrong, she added, must be rectified. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now end this show with some Rababa song from Blue Nile State in Sudan.
Sudan,
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 We have been listening to some Rababa song from Blue Nile State in Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.